This is Mark Strassman, reporter with California Politics Today. We're about to speak to Robert Fayer. Mr. Fayer is a partner in the law firm of Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. Welcome to Utopia Media's California Politics Today.
Thank you.
Could you say, as you speak up plenty loud so everyone will be able to hear it, the relationship between Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe as a bond counsel to State Treasurer Phil Angelides? What are your how'd you get the job, and what are your responsibilities in it?
Well, the bond counsel is a role which has existed for over 100 years, where states and local governments, when they wish to issue bonds to fund their different projects, seek the advice of outside lawyers who specialize in this area of law. And the ultimate purpose of having bond counsel is to get an opinion from counsel at the time bonds are issued, which is given to the investors in the bonds. And this opinion basically addresses two things. One is that the bonds have been validly issued under the Constitution and laws of the state in question, where the bonds originate.
Right.
And secondly, that the interest on the bonds is exempt from federal income taxation. We are one of the relatively small number of law firms around the country that has a national reputation and a long history doing this kind of work. We originated our firm, although now national and international in scope, started in San Francisco. Our history goes back more than 150 years in San Francisco, and we were, until really a couple of decades ago, really totally a California firm. And so we have had a many, many decades-long relationship in as bond counsel with the state of California. And we have been the state's bond counsel for many decades. We regularly are asked by the treasurer. The treasurer regularly does a solicitation, it's called a request for proposals, in which they ask many law firms to submit proposals and present their experience and their ability to provide bond counsel services to the state. And we have consistently been selected by both this treasurer and past treasurers to serve as the bond counsel for state general obligation bonds, and we continue in that role.
How long does your current agreement with the state extend?
It was most recently renewed in June of this past year for a two-year period.
Okay. You mentioned bonds that were exempt from federal income tax.
Yes.
That's a slightly more complicated way of describing what are commonly called tax-exempt bonds.
That's correct.
Okay. Or also sometimes tax-free bonds.
Yes.
Okay.
Those are all terms for the same.
Okay. Could you review for our listeners what Proposition 71, which passed 5941 last November, said about bonds? And how important the bond provisions were in that initiative?
Well, the bond provisions were extremely important because the bonds were the source of funding for the program which the initiative established under the state constitution and state laws.
Right.
What the initiative did was have the voters authorize the issuance of up to $3 billion of state general obligation bonds. General obligation bonds of the state are one of the types of debt which the state is capable of issuing. They general obligation bonds are particularly beneficial as a form of financing because they carry what is called the full faith and credit of the state. In other words, the state's general fund is pledged, not specifically legally pledged, but is completely backs the repayment of the bonds, and the payments on the bonds are the second highest priority of the use of any of the state's monies that come into the general fund. And, of course, the state's general fund is where all of the tax revenues from the state, from the income tax, corporations tax, sales tax, and so forth, on the order of $80 to $90 billion a year, this all goes in the state's general fund. And The highest priority is the payment of support of education. This is under the state constitution. And once payments for education are taken care of, the next highest priority is the repayment of state general obligation bonds. So these are the highest credit and the best type of debt that the state can issue.
We could almost call it the gold standard of bonds.
Generally speaking, right.
Okay.
And under the state constitution, in order for these bonds to be issued, they have to be approved by the voters. Otherwise, the state is generally not permitted to enter into long-term bonding, which commits the state general fund for repayment.
Can the legislature make that commitment?
Not without voter approval. Most of the time, actually, most bond measures which come before the voters are put on the ballot by the legislature.
Right.
It's only been relatively few cases where this has been done by the initiative process, which was what was used in Proposition 71. But whether proposed by initiative or by the legislature, the ultimate approval has to come from the voters at a general election, statewide general election, where it must be approved by a 51% majority vote.
Okay. Are these general obligation bonds tax exempt in the way we've been talking about?
Well, that's not a matter of state law.
Okay.
The general obligation really only relates to the state's obligation to repay the bonds.
Right.
How much interest, what the interest rate is on the bonds, is a matter, depending on the market, of course,
right,
from time to time, and also on the tax status of the bond. Bonds can be either tax-exempt, as we've described, or they can be taxable.
And what determines that distinction?
Well, that really is what we do as bond counsel. What we do is analyze the federal tax regulations. There are very complicated body of both law in the Internal Revenue Code and then detailed regulations that have been adopted by the Internal Revenue Service under the tax code, which describe and provide the rules for what bonds are able to be tax exempt and which are not.
Was it the intention of the authors of Prop 71, and does it contain language that indicates that these bonds will be tax exempt?
The legislation very clearly allows either tax exempt or taxable bonds to be issued. I can't speak for what the intent of the draft.
But the language allows for either.
Either, that's correct.
And now the ICOC, which was also set up by Prop 71,
right,
voted in May at one of its meetings to authorize on its own behalf $3 billion in these general revenue bonds, as well as a specific issuance, as I understand it, of $300 million for the first year, and also had a provision for $300 million in bond anticipation notes. Is that basically right?
Well, let me correct a couple of things.
Please.
With regard to that. First of all, let me just finish up one prior thing with regard to tax exemption. What
Please.
I described is the fact that there are these complicated set of tax regulations. As bond counsel, it's our role to interpret those, apply those rules to the particular facts of each proposed bond issue that the state does,
again, right,
whether for stem cell research, whether for school construction, whether for parks and highways, et cetera, et cetera. We look at the proposed use of the bond proceeds, we look at the laws, and then we provide advice to the state as to whether or not we believe the bonds would qualify as tax exempt or not, and if we believe they do qualify as tax exempt, then we put that into our opinion, and the marketplace will accept that opinion and price the bonds. They'll give a rate on the bonds which assumes that they are tax exempt.
So, from the point of view of the state wants them to be tax exempt because then they can offer a lower rate of
right.
interest.
As much as possible, we always try to make the bonds to structure the bonds and to find a way to make them tax exempt, of course, because it's a lower cost to the state.
Is it possible to say anything in general about what the bonus is there, how much lower the interest rates can be when they are tax exempt, given the vagaries of interest rates and fluctuations and so on.
Yeah, again, this varies depending on a number of factors.
Right, but it's a range or a percentage.
The kind of the rule of thumb that has been used for many years is that it's about 2 percentage points difference on the interest rate, certainly for long-term bonds.
And what kind of interest rates in general are we talking about here?
Well,
exempt or non-exempt?
Well, on the exempt, and I can't really speak to non-exempt because we generally don't issue taxable state bonds.
Right.
Though we have done some in the past.
Right.
Long-term state bonds are will be in the high 4%, low 5% range.
Okay.
Oh, right around 5%.
And long-term is
The state sells its bonds over a 30-year period. The repayment is over 30 years, so
right.
That would be... So they pay back some amount of bonds every year, so a typical bond issue which might pay back in full over 30 years might have an average life of around 15 years, since some is being paid back every year. Taking all the interest rates into account, the average is probably around 5% under current circumstances.
An investor who buys, say, $1 million worth of these bonds, what would they expect over the life of that contract to get back?
Well, that depends on what maturity they're buying. See, the what we have is what's called a yield curve,
right,
in the debt market, so that the longer the bond is outstanding, the higher the interest rate, because the investor is taking more risks for a longer period of time.
Right.
And the risk is less a risk of repayment, because, again, these bonds are backed by the full faith and credit of the state.
Right.
But it's a risk of a change in interest rates. If the bondholder holds the bond until final maturity, that's fine. He gets back the interest rate. He gets his full principal back at the end of 20 years.
Right.
But if you hold a 20-year bond and you want to sell it at year 10, say the typical bond has a $5,000 amount on it. I mean,
right. Unit.
Minimum denomination,
right.
Typical denomination.
Right.
Well, you've paid $5,000 to buy the bond, and you're getting, 4.5% per year interest on the bond.
Right.
And you're going to get this for 20 years. So if you hold it for 20 years, you'll get your $5,000 back, and you've gotten every year the 4.5% interest. But if you want to sell the bond in year 10, the value of the bond, whether someone will pay you $5,000 for it or pay you more or pay you less, depends on what interest rates are like at that time, because when you sell that bond at year 10, it is still going to be bearing 4.5% interest.
Right.
And if interest rates have gone up between today and 10 years from now, then 4.5% interest isn't really the current market.
But and again, if they've gone down,
it's worth more.
It's worth more.
So, but the point is that the longer the bond is outstanding, the more the holder is taking a risk as to what's going to happen to rates over that period of time. So they want a higher return over the longer period of time, which is to say, is that generally in the debt markets you have a yield curve where the interest rate on a bond is a function of what its maturity is. And the longer the maturity, the higher the interest rate is. So, and this is all for bonds which have the identical credit, which is the state's credit.
Right.
The state's credit is the same behind a 2-year bond and behind a 20-year bond.
Right.
But the 20-year bond has a higher interest rate on it because that's the nature of the debt market and the yield curve.
And the bonds proposed under Prop 71 were for a 30-year term.
Well, right. I mean, that's been the proposition itself doesn't specify
what
the term of the bond is. That's going to be determined by the state treasurer when he goes in the market each time. But what I was saying is that typically the state sells, when it sells its general obligation bonds, it sells them for an up to 30-year period,
right.
But there is some bonds maturing each year over the course of the 30 years. And so if the say the long bond, the 30-year bond, may have a 5.5% interest rate.
Right.
But what I said, the average over all of the bonds taken together would be less than that.
Okay.
Because you're also averaging in the, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5-year bonds, which have, you know, which are now maybe at a 2.5% interest rate.
Okay.
But those are very short.
Okay. I think
so.
I,
you have this blending of all the interest rates. So I'm just saying,
right,
the average rate on a long-term 30-year bond today may be around 5%, and on a tax exempt basis.
Okay, and on 1 year,
about half, much shorter. I'd have to pull out. I'm not a number. I don't.
Right. Okay. Here, all right. So in terms of the counsel that you provide, so there's a back and forth between your office and the Treasurer's office when they talk to you about where the money is going, and you tell them whether that's going to make a tax exempt or not. Essentially, is that?
Yes, we do. That is quite correct. We do have a dialogue,
right,
between, well, not only the Treasurer's office, but most importantly with the state agency which is responsible for the program. The Treasurer's office can't really tell,
right,
the state agency what to do with the bonds. First of all, it's governed by the bond law which the voters pass,
right,
and then we have discussions with the departments, typically the state agencies, and
right,
find out what their programs are like, and then we provide advice. And often, the state agency is able to tailor their program,
right,
or adjust their program to be able to maximize the use of tax-exempt bonds.
Right.
That's the process that we understand.
Okay, and in fact, what's implicit in what you just said is what determines the tax-exempt status of a bond is the purposes to which the money is put. Is that a fair characterization?
That is the majority. Yes, that is the main rule that governs the tax exemption. There are certain other rules affecting the tax-exempt status of the bonds, dealing with other types of financial issues, but those are much too technical for your purposes.
Right. Okay, so
that is quite right.
Okay, and having established that it's the disposition of the funds that determines,
right,
the tax exempt status,
yes,
what are the criteria that make the disposition of those funds tax exempt?
Well,
what are the criteria there?
There are a lot of criteria, and I'm not really sure.
As a general proposition,
it's hard to really try to boil it down to a soundbite.
Right,
but
you've got all the time here you need.
Well, you're going to...
Long sentence. No,
it's good. You're going to condense it. But the area that is of the greatest, has the greatest impact and is the issue that has been very important in our analysis of the bonds for stem cell research under Prop 71, is the concept of private activity bonds or private use. The basic rule under the tax exempt bonds is that the bond proceeds have to be used for public purposes, for governmental purposes, and not for private purposes.
Right.
And the tax law and the regulations have some specific guidelines for how to measure whether bond proceeds are used for private purposes. And so the principal type of analysis that we have to deal with most state bonds is whether or not there are private uses, is really more than private purposes, whether there's private use of the proceeds of the bonds. It's really a two-part test, whether there's private use and whether there are private payments coming out from the private sector that are used to directly or indirectly repay the debt service on the bond.
Now, does that mean that if the bond proceeds are used for private purposes, that they can't be tax exempt?
The general rule is correct. The general rule is that if you have bond proceeds that have a sufficiently high amount, and there are thresholds, there are dollar and percentage thresholds, that have a sufficiently high amount of private use and of private payments, then you have what is called a private activity bond. And the general rule is that private activity bonds are taxable. Now, that there are exceptions to that, and I don't want to go into a lot of details,
right,
about it. And there are other techniques that can be used when the state sells bonds, which will allow a certain amount, a certain small amount of private use out of a state bond where the bond still will be tax exempt.
What kind of private use would that be,
for example? I'll give you a very clear example of something, for instance, which is theoretically permitted under the Proposition 71, although nobody knows if the Institute, the Stem Cell Institute, would want to do it.
Right.
But the initiative, of course, allows both grants and loans to be made from bond proceeds.
Right.
And either grants or loans also can be made either to nonprofit organizations or universities, or to for-profit entities.
Right.
So one, it is theoretically possible, at least it's permitted by the initiative, for the institute to receive a request, for funding, research funding request, from a private biotech company like Genentech. And I just picked that out because everybody knows the name.
Right.
And Genentech says, we've got this idea to do some research, and we'd like you to fund it.
Right.
And the Stem Cell Institute may decide, okay, that's really good science, and we'd like to fund this, but we'd also like to, we don't, since it's Genentech, and you guys, are money-making people, we don't necessarily want to give you a grant, we'll make you a loan.
Right.
We'll loan you the money, and you can pay it back to us over a period of time, and they'd negotiate some terms for the loan. Maybe it would be a low interest or good terms that would make it attractive for Genentech to want to get this source of funding rather than just sell stock or fund this research from some other source.
Or sell their own bonds.
Well, theoretically, right. Now, that is private use because the bond proceeds are going to be used by a private company in their own activity, although the research maybe has public purposes, but it's being done by Genentech, a private corporation. And Genentech is going to pay back the loan, so the state is going to get money back from Genentech. That is sort of classic, that is a classic situation of private use which would give rise to private activity.
Okay,
if we had a bond issue, and this again oversimplifies,
right.
But if the state sold a bond issue and all of the proceeds of the bond issue were used to make a loan to Genentech for their research, and Genentech paid the money back to the state, paid that loan back, that would be a private activity bond. That would have to be done on a taxable basis, not a tax exempt.
Regardless of how much, whether that loan was at market rates or below market rates.
Regardless of what the rates are on the loan, right.
And that would be considered private use.
Yes, right.
And it wouldn't, would that mean that part of the bonds couldn't be tax exempt?
Well, basically,
do all the purposes have to be tax exempt in order for the bonds to be sold that way? The
basic rule is that at least 90% of the bond proceeds have to be used for non-private activity purposes.
Okay. Now,
that's what I'm saying. A small, in theory, actually, put differently, there's a 10% limit. There's a 10% allowance for private use in a tax-exempt bond, but not to exceed $15 million.
In any
one sale of state bonds. See, the state typically sells its bonds in large amounts, $500, $750 million, billion dollars at a time.
Right.
Got tens of billions of dollars of bonds that have been voted by the voters over the years that are still ready to be needed to be issued, mostly for, obviously, all of other than stem cells, for schools, for university construction, for parks, for water programs, whole litany of things.
And to cover the debt. And to cover the state debt.
Right, and they're all payable. These are all general obligation bonds. And the state sells, the treasurer sells bonds for a number of different ones at the same time, since they're all, investors don't care if they're funding schools or parks, because it doesn't make any difference. They're all getting paid back from the state general fund. So the state sells large bond issues. Up to $15 million of any one of these bond issues can be used for what would otherwise be prohibited private activity debt.
For those purposes, that $15 million for each,
yeah.
if the Stem Cell Institute sold $300 million every year for 10 years, would that be $15 million a year? Or
$15 million
over the $3 billion?
$15 million each time there's a sale of bonds.
Right.
The state generally sells bonds five or six times a year. So I mean, however, the stem cell program isn't entitled to get $15 million from each bond sale because there are other programs
right.
that may need to have some of this private activity
allocation. So that's
so there. That's for every. I mean, so there's
okay.
we there are water programs. There are safe drinking water.
So with the 300 million that are supposed to be issued each year, that would be bundled into an even larger sale.
Well, and it won't be sold at one time. There might be, you know, in the six bond sales, right? We may have 30 million of stem cells
right.
in January, and then 30 more million in March.
Just to divide it, if you divide 300 million by, we're not getting into fancy
numbers
here.
Yeah, it could very well be, you'd very well have
multiple opportunities per year.
Right.
So if you divided the 300 six times into 50 pieces, you'd do that. You'd be able to do that. You'd have to spend 75 million of the 300 million for private purposes. Is that by that calculation?
Yeah, theoretically. I mean, I'm not at all sure that would happen in the real world.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, and how would it differ if the University of California said, we want to, instead of Genentech's, University of California said, we want to do some research, the same research for that matter.
Exactly.
What are the controlling parameters there?
Well, there you don't have because the University of California is a governmental institution, not a private institution.
Right.
The research itself, the doing of the research, does not give rise to any private activity concerns.
Just back one step.
Yes.
From what you said about the loans and the partial allowances and so on,
right.
Does this all mean that Genentech could not get a grant of any amount from this?
That's an interesting wrinkle on this.
Right.
Grants generally don't give rise to private activity concerns because, remember I said, the private activity has two parts to it. One is private use, but the other is a private payment back.
Right.
In a grant, you don't have a payment. That's what a grant is. A grant is giving the money away.
Right.
And so, in fact, we could give, the Stem Cell Institute could give a grant to Genentech for research,
as long as
they got nothing back. Then you would not have a private problem, private activity.
Really?
Problem.
So if they give the money, if they get the money back, there is a private activity problem. If they don't get it back, there isn't.
There isn't.
That seems a little counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Well, that's the way. A lot of these tax rules are counterintuitive, and I won't try to justify.
No.
It. That's the way the Treasury works.
Right.
But the issues that have been raised about intellectual property.
Right.
Come about because if we stopped right there, things would be simple. Grants to any researchers, no problem because there's no payment back. If you made a loan, if you made these as loans, no problem if it's to the UC, no problem if it's to Stanford or to USC or to Hope Institute.
Are private universities, though, are nonprofit institutions.
Right, nonprofit institutions.
And have the same status as the University of California
for
these purposes.
For taxes and bond purposes,
right.
In a nutshell, yes, they do.
Private universities do.
Right, because they're also 501c3, as we call them.
Right.
They're, as are all the Burnham and these other
right.
City of Hope and the other research institutions.
Right.
When you get into the problem that we've been struggling with is that it isn't that simple. It doesn't stop there. There is this whole concept of intellectual property rights.
Okay. Tell us how that impacts the process.
Well, we don't know yet how it does because everybody's still kind of swirling around trying to figure out what to do.
Before you talk about the swirling, who is it that determines that? It's the IRS at the federal government level, right, that determines whether a particular application of funds is tax-exempt or not? Are they the final authority?
They are the final authority.
Absent legal contestation of their decision, presumably.
Well,
do that. What they say goes. Is that
you can. I mean,
right.
what happened, this area of finance, municipal bonds, as I've described, have worked up to now, and sort of for various reasons, it's the only way it works practically, based upon the opinions of counsel, as I said.
Right.
We give our opinions, in most instances, we're willing to give our opinion based on our experience, long experience, and the expertise of the lawyers in our firm who do this work, based on analysis of the rules and regulations, then we write our opinion. there is a process by which you can ask the Internal Revenue Service for a ruling
right.
on a particular set of circumstances. This is, however, on the normal cases, it is always time-consuming. It takes them usually many months
right.
to do this, and expensive. And most
do the people asking for the ruling need to pay for it?
Yes. You pay a fee.
Right.
Well, you pay the IRS a fee,
right.
plus you have to pay the lawyers quite a bit of money to go through the process of
right.
of writing it up and meeting and talking with the IRS and so on.
Right.
So most bonds are sold without getting an advance ruling from the Internal Revenue.
Is the problem in general here that this is uncharted territory?
This is uncharted. Yeah, we're going to get to the fact that in this area we are almost certainly going to have to go to the Internal Revenue Service for a ruling because it is so much uncharted territory.
Okay.
But where the only other area where it really gets tested is the IRS also has the legal ability, as it does with any taxpayer, to do an audit. They can come in after the fact
right.
and do an audit and go back and in hindsight look at a bond issue and look at what was done with the bond proceeds and determine whether they did meet the rules or not. And then the IRS has the ability, if their auditors conclude that the rules and regulations were not complied with, they can administratively determine that the interest on the bonds is in fact taxable and not tax exempt.
And of course, then the purpose of getting a ruling ahead of time is that the IRS is on record saying this is okay.
Once they give you a ruling, then they can't.
Right.
They're bound. That locks them in.
So the decision is: do you want to spend the money to get the ruling, or do you want to take your chances that you're doing it okay?
In a nutshell, that's right. And again, 98% of the time, everybody's comfortable without getting a ruling because we've done this many times before. Or there are, I mean, for instance, there is precedent. I mean, the IRS has issued regulations. They have issued many rulings over the time, and these all are available. They're public information, so we can go back and look at what the IRS has told other taxpayers, other bond issuers.
Okay, now what are the uncharted issues here?
Well, the uncharted issue really is how to deal with intellectual property rights and the payments that come out of it, the royalties, the intellectual property royalties. And that's the real nub of it, because what you've got is take the simple case that you've described here, Stanford.
Right.
Stanford gets a grant from the ICOC
right.
to do stem cell research, maybe down the road where it's going to really reach some applied science.
Or it makes some fundamental breakthrough that needs to be licensed
for
everybody
else.
It leads to
knowledge which then gets patented.
Right.
It leads to a patent.
Right.
And
someone's going to own that.
If we follow the federal rule, Bayh-Dole rules, Stanford's going to own the patent, is going to have the patent rights.
Okay.
Okay? And they are then going to be, undoubtedly, what the ICOC will put in to the initial grant
right.
is an obligation. Say, if you get a patent, you've got to make your utmost efforts to then turn the patent into a commercially usable therapy or
right.
drug or something that's going to actually, you know, help the disease, cure the disease.
Right. For example, license it to Genentech
to
make a kit.
Exactly. But who is going to then actually take the knowledge and develop a drug
right.
and get the drug licensed by the FDA
right.
and then we have to sell it? It's going to be the private sector.
Right.
And they're going to do that on a license
because Stanford, as a nonprofit, can't be in the business of making therapies.
They don't have the skill. That's
right.
not their. That's not what they do.
But Genentech, who has
the experience and the skill
right.
to take the basic science,
right.
take the knowledge, and turn it into a usable, again, a drug,
as,
a therapy,
right.
a device, you know.
As well as navigate the FDA approval process. And do the marketing,
right.
and so on.
And of course, they then, of course, reap the profits from this,
or right.
the returns from this. And of course, the patent license normally has in it, Stanford is the owner of the patent,
right.
says, good, if you make money out of this, you're going to pay us a license fee.
Right.
We'll get something back.
Right.
And what all of this is about is how much will the state get out of it? Can the state get a piece of that license?
Okay. Now, first, what does Prop 71 say about what the state would get from that?
Nothing specific.
So there are no guarantees that the state would get any part of those royalties?
There's no specific guarantee. There is a direction in Prop 71 that the Institute should attempt to obtain as much benefit for the state as it can. I don't have the wording right in front of me.
There's a general directive
to the Institute to try to maximize intellectual property returns to the state, but balanced with other considerations.
But it doesn't say...
You're right, it doesn't say the state must get 10% back.
You were saying before that Prop 71 admonishes the patent holders to do everything they can to get benefit out of this.
That's not in Prop 71.
Oh.
I was saying that I'm going to assume that the act, when the Institute makes grants,
right.
Part of the grant is going to be... Conditions, exactly. Grant conditions are going to include conditions governing the intellectual property that the grantee may develop from the results of the research.
Beyond what you said in that context originally, that they should encourage its commercialization, but you didn't say whether, and what you've just now said addresses whether Prop 71 requires the terms and conditions of those grants to include any specific percentage returned to the state from the grantee.
No, it does not. That is all policy that the ICOC will have to ultimately determine.
Okay. Has the ICOC determined that policy, or is it in the process?
I'm in some process. I don't know how far along.
Now, depending on what policies they implement in that regard, what impact does that have on the total process with particular reference to the tax-exempt status of the bonds?
This is where the circle all turns back.
Right.
To the extent that the state ultimately will get some money back, and that the research is now, remember I said, although the research grant was first given to Stanford, the benefits of the research now are going to be are being used by Genentech.
Right.
So arguably, you do have private use of the state grant,
right.
The original research grant, and you might have payments from Genentech as the licensee, patent licensee now.
Right.
Through royalties, payments back to the state. If that occurs, let me just finish.
Okay.
In that circumstance, you have a set of circumstances that look like a situation that looks like a private activity use.
Because of the return of funds.
Because there's a return of funds, and because you have a benefit, you have the private sector benefiting from the research results that were funded by the state bond.
Now, okay, what I was going to ask, I'm sorry to seem like I was interrupting, but wouldn't the Genentech money be going to Stanford as the licensor of the patent?
If all the Genentech money went to Stanford, we wouldn't have a problem. What the issue here is just this, is will the state get some of this?
But Stanford,
and that's what Senator Ortiz is in a big, that's what all this political debate is about that's going on, SCA 13 and elsewhere. There are those who think the state should get some money back, given that they were investing $6 billion, ultimately, of principal and interest in funding this exercise.
Well, but Stanford would be under no obligation return any money from its royalties to the state, would it?
Unless it was in the original grant agreement.
So
the original grant agreement might require Stanford to share or to provide to make some percentage of its patent license royalties.
And under under the structure that you've discussed, would that render the bonds ineligible for tax-exempt status if Stanford were to pay back money from the grant?
It might. And that's the fuzzy area right now in terms in our analysis, and we've told this to Senator Ortiz. This is not secret. This is public knowledge that we've raised these issues. And this is the area which is, this has never been done. Nobody's ever tried to use large amounts of tax-exempt bond proceeds or bond fund, you know, government bond proceeds, the government bond program, to fund scientific research, which then may result in patents and licenses. So we don't, there's no history.
That's the essence of the uncharted territory.
That's the essence of the uncharted territory, and we are, so there is a lot of discussion going on. There are people in the legislature, at the CIRM, in the, you know, with the universities, the research people. There's a lot of stakeholders and interested parties in this question, and we're really at the beginning of a exactly this kind of dialogue, which I described to you before, about how this should work. And one of the components that will go into the ultimate policy decision is what implication does this have for the bonds as to whether they can be tax exempt or not.
Right.
Somebody else has to decide how important that is.
Right.
Not us.
Right.
But we just advise, if you do this,
right,
then we can give an opinion. If you do it the other way, we can't give an opinion. Or more likely, we say, you know, what we think we want to do, we obviously want to. It's our goal, as I said at the beginning.
Right.
We want to find a way to do this, to be able to do tax-exempt bonds for as much of this program as possible.
Right. Now, based
we want to save the state the money and the taxpayers.
Right.
But this ultimately is going to involve, a dialogue, back and forth, planning and discussions with the stakeholders who are involved in it, the CIRM, the legislature, to the extent they're going to get involved, et cetera, and the IRS. And we're going to ultimately have to go to the IRS and get their sign-off on some intellectual property regime that will then go forward with this program.
Now, do you see the outline of such a regime that you think would pass that muster?
Not yet.
It has to do with whether Stanford gives money back to the state or not, doesn't it?
There are a lot of other ideas that are floating out there. People are proposing,
What are some proposals?
Some ideas that are being proposed are that instead of the money going to the state, say there's a desire to get some benefit from this, from the state's investment.
Right.
Instead of having a direct stream of payments from Genentech go back to the state.
Right.
Instead, some of that money will go to a nonprofit organization that is going to be created.
Right.
That will get money from all these licenses.
Right.
And then we'll use it to subsidize health care for California citizens.
Right.
Low income California citizens.
It's kind of a tax shelter for the proceeds here, in a way.
I'm not going to characterize it. It's an idea.
Right.
That's one idea.
So it'll be a non.
And there may be some other idea is, again, it would be to ask to have Genentech provide some of the drugs at a lower cost.
Right.
As a condition of getting this license. So there are a number of ideas that are being kicked around to provide a public. The theory here is let's get some benefit back to the state or its citizens in a way that doesn't cause tax problems.
Now,
So these ideas are out there. And, you know, I don't know which ones are going to ultimately see light of day. I mean, there are, quite aside from the tax considerations, you know, some people are going to argue that Genentech's not even going to get into this business if you sort of force them to to provide low-cost drugs for sufficient people.
The impetus for solving this problem, though, is the political pressure to say that the state and its taxpayers need to get something back. Absent that, everything is okay. Things could proceed if Genentech kept the money and Stanford kept the money, right?
Right, or that whoever got license royalties back was not the state. It's possible. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't disagree with that.
So if people
that's
just,
sort of at the bottom of it. Yeah.
If people just forgot about this and said, oh, we don't care,
Genentech
would keep the money, Stanford would keep the money.
But that's
not going to happen.
Right.
Okay.
That isn't what's happening. Right.
Okay. Let me switch gears a little bit over to the now consolidated lawsuit that's been brought against the ICOC, which is now a combined bond, a reverse a reverse validation action, also known as a reverse or as an invalidation action or a reverse validation action, that would render it impossible for the ICOC to issue any of these bonds.
Yeah, let me make clear. The ICOC does not issue bonds.
Who would be issuing the bonds?
The bonds are issued by the state.
Okay.
And there is a committee that's created under the Bond Act, under Prop 71.
Which has the big four elected officials?
Well, it has three government officials, the treasurer, the controller, and the director of finance.
Right.
And three members of the ICOC board constitute what is called the Finance Committee.
Right.
And that is the entity that actually supervises the issuance of the bonds, and that is the entity that in May, early May, authorized the issuance of a certain amount of bonds and bond anticipation notes, not the ICOC.
Okay.
Actually.
All right. So it's almost like a hybrid cell here. It combines elements from the state, the elected state government, with the
ICOC.
With the ICOC.
Yeah. That's
okay.
Correct.
Kind of a hybrid cell there.
Whatever.
Okay. What did it do in May exactly?
It passed some resolutions which authorized the issuance of the bonds that are authorized, that were voted by the voters.
Right.
And the significance of that is that that triggered a 60-day period within which, under state law, anybody had the ability to challenge the legality of the bonds. And that is what one group did by filing suit on day 59, challenging the validity of the bond issues.
The attorney who did that told me that he was waiting for the I guess it's the Finance Committee to file a validation action, which it had that period of time to do.
There are two choices. Right. Either the government itself has the ability to file an action to ask a court to validate the legality of a bond issue.
There are
60 days to do that. Also, any opponent, anybody in the public, has the right to file a suit against the government saying, we believe these bonds are not valid.
Does the government need to file that in order to...
It does not need to. It does not need,
need to. It can, but it doesn't have to.
And
so the opponents waited until gave them a chance to do that. They didn't do that. Then
they filed first. And it's called a reverse validation just because it means that it was the opponents who filed first rather than the state who filed first. The end result, the result is the same type of a proceeding.
Right.
In either case.
Okay. They
filed that suit. Right.
Right. Now, and that suit asks what of whom?
Well, fundamentally, it asks the court to declare that Proposition 71 is unconstitutional for a number of different reasons.
Right.
And to prohibit the state from issuing the bonds that have been authorized by the
What's your expert legal opinion on the strength of that case?
I do not have an opinion.
Okay.
We haven't been retained to be involved in that case.
Okay, but from your
attorney general is defending.
Right, he is.
Case,
What's the significance of that case in terms of the issuance of the bonds?
The significance of it is that it really makes it, given the pending litigation.
Right.
Neither we nor the Attorney General, who also sort of acts as a part, coordinates with us, as they're not strictly bond counsel because they're in-house rather than independent counsel.
Right.
But traditionally, the Attorney General gives the same opinion as bond counsel does to investors and to the state.
Essentially taking your lead?
Well, we work together.
Right, okay.
It's not one leading the other.
Okay.
We work in concert. And so neither we nor the Attorney General are in a position to give required in the industry as an unqualified opinion as to the validity of the Prop 71 bonds while this litigation is pending challenging their validity.
What's the significance? There was an organization I didn't know about until last week called the California Debt and Investment Advisory Commission, CDIAC.
Right. Yeah.
I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Oh yeah.
And I was told that the Finance Committee hadn't filed anything with it. Does it need to file a report or a form with that
as
a precursor to getting the validation,
after the
validation action's been decided?
It is required to file only. It is only required to file. the statute that you cited in your
Section 8855
requires that an issuer of bonds file a notice, a report,
right,
with the CDIAC,
right,
30 days before the sale of any bond.
Right.
So it was not necessary to file any report before the validation or at any. Nobody is late or in,
right,
violation of this,
right,
requirement.
But, right. Not in any violation, but they can't sell the bonds until they've filed that and waited 30 days.
That's
is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And they're not going to file it until this litigation is resolved, are they? As far as you can tell.
Well, that is going to get us over into talking about the bond anticipation notes.
Okay, well, let's talk about them then.
If you're ready to go.
I'm ready to go into those.
Right.
I think I wanted to just clear up, though, something, yeah, I'd gone over several times with people in the Treasurer's office about the marketability of these bonds pending this litigation. They've been telling me, essentially, that it's legal, but it can't be done.
Well,
are they right about
theoretically,
that?
Theoretically, I mean... The answer is, yeah, it can't be done. The marketplace, people aren't going to, investors are not going to buy the bonds.
You'll see where this leads into the bond anticipation notes, obviously.
Right. Yeah, I know, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the investors will not buy these bonds with a legal cloud over them because they don't have to. They got plenty of other places to
right.
invest their money.
Right.
And the state's not going to pay them an interest rate high enough to lure them in.
Okay. In this situation in which the bonds can't be sold because of the pending litigation, the chair of the ICOC, Robert
right.
Klein, has repeatedly said that he's working on plans to sell bond anticipation notes. What's the legal status of all that?
Well, the bond anticipation notes also were authorized by that finance committee back in May.
Right, to the tune of $300 million, right?
Up to 200, actually.
Up to 200, okay.
$200 million.
Okay.
And the I think the understanding or the plan with respect to those, as I think has been said by others in the public,
right.
publicly, is that these would not be sold to typical investors.
Right.
These would be purchased by charitable institutions, foundations, probably in the medical research arena.
Right.
That would be buy these bond anticipation notes essentially as a way of making bridge financing available to the institute.
Where does the need for bridge financing come?
Well, because the institute would like to start making some grants,
right?
And they don't have any money to
right.
make any grants
okay.
until somebody can sell some kind of an
okay.
instrument.
Okay, that's why they want the bridge financing.
Right? Exactly.
And this is supposed to bridge the time between now and when the litigation's over, right?
Right. That's
okay.
basically it. Right.
Okay.
Now what is being proposed here is that the investors, or the people, I hardly even really call them investors, charitable institutions
right.
that would provide this funding, are basically going to buy the bond anticipation notes, understanding that the only way that the bond anticipation notes will be paid back
right.
is if the state is successful in the litigation
right.
and it is then able to sell bonds, and the bonds will pay off the notes.
That's right.
Call bond anticipation
that's right.
notes. These are issued in anticipation of bonds being issued at a later time.
Right. Now, in an appearance on both on public television and public radio, Mr. Klein indicated that two specific elements in that proposal.
Mm-hmm.
One, that there was a 5% chance that they'd lose. And secondly, that if the, which you've already mentioned, the second provision, that if the ICOC loses the litigation, then the bond purchases will be converted to grants to the ICOC.
Well, they're not. I mean, I'm not sure I'd characterize it that way. I mean, what will happen is that they're not going to get their money back.
Right.
Which means they have made a grant.
the
loan, it's not going to be converted in any formal fashion.
It'll just de facto become a grant.
De facto becomes, yeah, right.
Can charitable institutions make charitable contributions like that? Is that
the
essence of what they often do?
Well, the Klein's point, and I have not heard those interviews.
Right.
But I believe what Mr. Klein's point about all this is he's going to go to institutions whose business it is to make grants.
Right.
For research of this nature.
Right.
And therefore...
And essentially ask them to make a grant, which would be, in a sense, become a loan.
Well,
if, or become...
Well,
huh?
they... ask them to provide funding, which they would expect. I think, you know, Mr. Klein, I believe most of the people in the state fully expect that these will be paid off, that the litigation will be successful. The but in the Mr. I'm not going to characterize a percentage, but if you take Mr. Klein's statement, if in the 5% chance that it turns out that a court decides that there was something fundamentally wrong,
right,
then they will have funded some research that they would have supported anyway, or is in within the, you know, scope of their interest,
right,
organization's interest, and, you know, and that's, and that's what happens.
So what why do bond anticipation notes as such have to come into this? Why can't he just ask them for contributions?
Well, you know, I suppose he could, and I mean, some people have been making contributions.
Ray Dolby and his wife apparently gave $5 million.
Yeah, gave $5 million, but
right.
You know, I mean.
So as an added,
all other things. All other things being equal, if we can fund this with the bonds, ultimately with the bonds, which is what the voters intended and what the drafters intended,
right?
That's essentially what the plan was, and then all of these charitable institutions are going to have that much more money to.
Right.
Do other research.
Right, but can the finance committee issue those bond anticipation notes while the litigation is pending?
Yes.
Okay. And will
they can issue them unless and until a court actually enjoins them from issuing?
Mr. Llewellyn, the attorney in the case, has said that if they try to issue bond anticipation notes, he'll try to enjoin them from doing that.
I read that in the paper. Yes.
Right, and. But
he's welcome to try.
They have the finance committee then has the authority now to issue those bond anticipation notes under the terms and conditions loosely defined by Mr. Klein in his public statements. Then, if they
I believe that is correct.
Okay.
Okay.
You've been very generous with your time. I would want to try to wrap up by getting a convergence here between the arguments in the lawsuit that seeks to declare the Proposition 71 unconstitutional and what we've been talking about in terms of the spending of the money and who gets it and pays it back and so on. Because in fact, the essence of the case brought by Dana Cody and the People's Advocate is under Article 16, Section 3 of the California Constitution, which says that an entity not under the control of the state cannot spend public funds and can't be granted funds by the state. And it seemed to me that the essence in Prop 71 was that it asked that the state provide it with $3 billion, that the state be obligated to pay $6 billion to retire those obligations, and that it be free of the control of the elected and bureaucratic apparatus of the state of California. Is that a fair characterization of what Prop 71 said? And if it did,
I'm just not going to try to characterize the lawsuits or how they characterized it.
Okay,
that's what the litigation's about.
Okay, what about the relationship between the argument made in the litigation and the point that we've been talking about here is these uncharted waters regarding the ownership of the intellectual property rights and who, under what terms and conditions, can be repaid and still keep these bonds tax exempt.
Well,
is that sort of the same question, or are those
separate
questions?
I don't think it is. I mean, it's a little bit hard to say, but one thing I think the gist of the lawsuit, the challenges, really have to do with the nature of the ICOC and the argument that it, as the entity that has been given the control over the expenditure of this $3 billion,
right,
it is not sufficiently a governmental entity and under the control of some, and again, that's their argument.
It's not a state agency.
It's not a state agency, notwithstanding, of course, that the Constitution, that the voters amended the Constitution specifically says it's a state agency, but that's what the litigation's about. But I think that's what it's about. I read the complaints.
Right.
I haven't done it in a little while. I don't know that the constitutional argument so much has to do with who's going to get the grants, whether it's Stanford or Genentech or so on. So
right.
I think it mostly has to do with who's going to decide how the grants are going to be made and to whom they're going to be given, rather than the nature of who it is that's going to get them.
What's the essence of the bond invalidation suit, though? Which
well, it raises a number of other issues. It does raise the same one, the reverse validation case.
Right.
Also mentions Article 16, Section 13. It also has a list of other supposed infirmities
right.
in the initiative, such as
the conflict of interest because of disease advocacy people,
rules,
right?
A violation of conflict of interest rules, violation right. of what's called the single subject rule,
right?
Attempting to make a constitutional revision rather than just an amendment. There's a number of technical arguments that they make
right.
dealing with various. You know, there's about six or seven or eight different, you know, different points. Again, not they don't really have any one theme to them. They are just. It's just the lawyers getting together. It's just lawyers sitting down and trying to fly-spec the thing and come up with. It was what we would call a shotgun approach.
Right.
A bunch of different pellets.
Right.
It's not a rifle bullet. It was a shotgun attempt to try to find some. They're hoping that at least one of their arguments will be successful with the court and be used as a basis to invalidate.
Right, but picture. Right isn't the core argument though that there's a paradox or a contradiction in being free of state control and being a state agency? Isn't that the
argument? I'm not going to characterize
okay.
that.
All right.
And I think the reverse validation action. I don't perceive that as something that sort of had any core. Theory behind it. I think it was just that. It was a shotgun
okay.
approach to try to,
okay.
to list, you know, a half a dozen or eight different...
What you call infirmities of
yeah, infirmities or you know, right, any one of which, if in theory, any one of which, if it was successful,
okay.
could lead the court to hold the... Again, now, court could also, you know, I don't know, you know, the court could decide, well, we were not going to hold the whole thing unconstitutional, maybe we'll just hold this one section.
Right.
You know, maybe they make it subject to conflict of interest rules, but
okay.
So, I mean, who knows what the...
Okay. Could you wrap up then for us by telling us what the unresolved issue is and what the timetable and the players in resolving it is likely to be from your perspective?
Well, the issues are those that are raised by the two lawsuits, which challenge the constitutionality of Proposition 71. And again, they're... You know, there is at least one of them, and there is these at least one sort of major argument about whether this is sufficiently a state government agency that has the constitutional ability to spend state money.
Right.
And then there are a series of other sort of more particular I would really call them technical arguments. But that is what is, you know, that is what is holding up the ability to issue the bonds.
The uncharted territory issues that we talked about earlier,
they're not holding anything up? I should say, those aren't going to hold up the issuance of bonds. Those have to do with tax exemption, and as I said at the very beginning,
right.
at the end of the day, we can issue taxable bonds if that is the will of the public officials who are in charge of selling the state's bonds.
Okay.
And it would mean some additional cost in interest cost to the state, but ultimately, there's no question in my mind that we can ultimately get an answer to those questions from the Internal Revenue Service,
right.
figure out what to do. Then the public policymakers will have to decide, are we willing to live within those limitations of what the Internal Revenue Service says we would have to, how we would have to limit intellectual property licensing, for instance. It'll become a trade-off. IRS says if you do it this way, you can get cheaper bond money.
Right.
The public officials will have to decide, is that trade-off worthwhile?
Right.
Or do we rather want to take the chance, and we don't even know if there's going to how much money there's going to be and when we're going to get it.
Right.
It's going to be for decades down the road. So but public officials will make that choice.
So, in fact, there are two distinct points here, then.
Right.
The lawsuits seek to invalidate the whole Proposition 71.
Right.
And if they succeed, there won't be a Proposition 71, there won't be a Stem Cell Institute, and there won't be any bonds.
Right. Then the whole thing goes away. Right.
But until that case is resolved, the bonds themselves aren't going to be issued, but the bond anticipation notes, under whatever terms the Finance Committee decides, may or may not be issued.
That is correct.
Would those bond anticipation notes be tax exempt or not?
Well, generally speaking, since we're talking about charitable institutions, essentially nonprofit foundations,
right,
being the buyers, they don't care. They don't pay taxes anyway.
They're tax exempt as
an
institution.
They're tax exempt institutions, so they're
okay.
They're indifferent.
So that's a moot point.
It's a moot point. Yeah,
okay.
It's a moot point for them.
And all of these uncharted issues that we've been talking
right.
about are going to eventuate in some sort of resolution through the IRS, which will input itself into the policy discussion, which will then decide how much people, the different players, mutually agree that they want to.
I think that's right. And that may take some months, many months.
But while
it's going on, we're not issuing bonds anyway. So
right.
And in any event, even if the litigation got resolved, say, sort of quickly, say in 6 months, and we still hadn't resolved the IRS issues, we could issue more bond anticipation notes. We could issue short-term debt that would have a very low interest rate anyway, where the difference between taxable and tax-exempt would be very small,
right,
while we finish the process with the Internal Revenue Service. So I think the tax, all of these tax things is a separate track. A lot of people are thinking about these issues, again, primarily intellectual property and issues and related questions, and I'm confident that eventually we'll get an answer to those things and the policymakers will then make their policy decisions. I should also say that it's also clear that quite a good part of the bond proceeds will be used for purposes that don't raise these tax issues. Not all of the grants are going to be for purposes that are going to result in a patent.
Right.
For instance, the very first grants that they're talking about doing are for training.
Right.
They're just going to pay graduate students and postdocs to learn more about stem cells, the fundamental science and the methods and the
technology. So there are no IPR issues.
Those
there.
Those don't have IPR.
And apparently 25% of the money is going to be spent on facilities.
Right. And
there's no patent.
I think 10% can be spent on facilities. And again, those don't raise the same kind of issues. So I'm sure that there are a number of elements to the proposal and a number of again, we've talked about techniques where we have these
right.
$15 million we can use. So there's a number of ways in which we can do tax-exempt bonds that without the intellectual property issues having an adverse impact.
Okay. What you said, you said 6 months would be a quick resolution.
Which I'm not really expecting. But I'm just saying.
Right. And that means that it's going to be at least 6 months until the case is resolved. There's also been an appeal filed by Mr. Llewellyn to move the consolidated case to Sacramento on the grounds that bond validation actions need to be heard in Sacramento. It says so right in the law. Do you have any view on whether that's going to...
No, I have no view on. Again, we're not... We're
but
not
but inevitably, it's going to draw the process out. Or maybe if it gets decided summarily, it wouldn't. Okay.
My understanding is, I just know what's sort of in the public. I know that
right.
the next step in the case, I'm told, is a conference that the judge in Alameda County who ordered the consolidation.
Right. There's a scheduling conference. Right.
I would imagine that unless Mr. Llewellyn gets the Court of Appeal
right.
to actually grant a stay or an order directing
that's what he's asking.
Sabraw
right.
to stop.
That's what he's asking.
He's going to go. You're right, but I mean, we'll see.
Right. Okay.
if he doesn't get that, I mean, he can still go on with his appeal.
Right.
And Judge Sabraw will continue with her process.
And so they could have the conference in Alameda, and eventually the case will move
Mr.
to Sabraw. Meanwhile,
Llewellyn is still arguing about whether it should be consolidated.
Right. Presumably he'd attend the conference anyway. I'll go to Alameda.
I'm not going to... You did ask. I really can't speculate again
okay.
on how long the litigation is going to take
right.
to get resolved.
But it remains the case that as long as the litigation and its offshoots continue, the core bonds can't be sold.
That's certainly the present belief.
And so the funding of this project would depend on the issuance and sale of these bond anticipation notes, which you've said is that point is you'd agree to that, right?
Okay. I think so.
And the decision about that resides with the finance committee, which is legally free to issue these to these charitable institutions as they've suggested, and they may or may not do that.
That's correct.
Okay, good. I want to thank you very much for an exhaustive and enjoyable discussion of all this.
Okay. I'm happy to try to. I've always been happy to try to educate people. These are complicated issues.
They are.
It always, I think, at the end, it's always helpful if the press and the public can try to understand them, even though they're some of them are complicated and technical.
That's right. And I hope as the process continues, maybe we can talk again and get some updates on how some of the things we've speculated might happen. Happen.
Okay. All right.
Okay, good. Well, thanks very much for your time and for all of this expertise.
Okay.
Okay, bye.